Your Grace, I must speak with you alone. It concerns the honor of my family.
Snatching a sealed letter from her trembling father's hand before he could change his mind, Miss Agatha Bellamy hurried through the crowded entrance hall of Blackmere House and stepped directly into the path of the most feared duke in the county. The collision stopped conversations across the room, not because she had stumbled, not because she had broken etiquette, but because nobody willingly stood in the way of Duke Nathaniel Harrow of Grenfell. The Duke lowered his gaze to the letter clutched against her chest. His expression barely shifted, yet half the room seemed to stop breathing. Agatha should have apologized and retreated. Instead, she remembered her father's desperate words spoken only an hour earlier. "Go to the Duke. Tell him exactly what I told you." Her courage nearly abandoned her right there in that hall. Surrounded by powdered wigs and practiced smiles and eyes that were already sharpening with gossip.
"Even so," she lifted her chin. "My father said you needed a wife," she murmured. The silence that followed felt endless. Several guests looked away. Others leaned closer. Everyone expected the Duke's temper. Everyone expected humiliation. What nobody expected was the faintest trace of amusement in the man's eyes. And then came the reply that would alter far more than Agatha Bellamy's future. "Perhaps," the Duke answered quietly. "You." And just like that, a house full of noble families found itself at the center of a scandal that had begun long before that evening, one about to uncover secrets neither family had buried as deeply as they believed.
"Now, tell me this. If a powerful Duke made such an offer in front of an entire room, would you trust his intentions? Or would you suspect he was hiding something far greater? Drop your answer in the comments right now, and tell us which beautiful part of the world you are watching from. Now, let's move on."
The words had barely left the Duke's lips before the room remembered how to breathe. "Perhaps," Duke Sebastian Ashford had said, his gray eyes settled on Agatha Bellamy with the kind of quiet certainty that made the air around him feel different from the air everywhere else. "You." Nobody moved. Nobody spoke. The entire entrance hall of Blackmere House held itself in a suspended, collective disbelief, the way a crowd holds itself when something happens that cannot be taken back, and everyone present understands it at once. And then, Miss Lavinia Croft moved. She came from the left side of the room, cutting through the stillness with practiced elegance. She was beautiful, pale and deliberate, with copper hair dressed high, and a manner so composed it could be mistaken for warmth by anyone who did not look closely enough. She had been standing near the Blackmere fireplace not 3 minutes before, surrounded by a small court of admirers who had gathered there the way people gather near things that shine. She had looked entirely comfortable, entirely certain of her position in the room. That certainty was what she carried with her now as she stepped forward, placing herself at a precise and deliberate angle between Agatha and the Duke, close enough to Duke Sebastian to suggest familiarity, close enough to Agatha to suggest a boundary.
"Your Grace," Lavinia said, her voice pitched perfectly, warm enough for the room to hear and sharp enough for Agatha to feel. "Surely you are tired from the journey up from Grenfell. You have only just arrived, and already half the county is determined to claim your attention."
She turned the smallest degree toward Agatha, the kind of turn that includes someone in a conversation while making absolutely clear they are not welcome in it. "I am certain Miss Bellamy understands." The room watched. Several fans moved faster. Two older gentlemen near the doorway exchanged a glance. Agatha understood perfectly. She understood the move, the positioning, the tone, the implication layered inside the courtesy. She had seen Lavinia Croft operate in social rooms before, and had always observed from a comfortable distance. Being the subject of it was an entirely different experience. She held her ground. She did not step back, and she did not look away from the Duke. Duke Sebastian did not look at Lavinia. He kept his gaze exactly where it had been, on Agatha, steady and unhurried, as though the interruption had not registered as meaningful enough to redirect his attention. Then, without raising his voice or altering his expression in any significant way, he spoke. "Miss Croft," he said simply.
You are standing in my way, it was said without cruelty. Lavinia's composure held. She drew back a single step, smiled at no one in particular, and turned away toward the fireplace with the particular grace of a woman who has decided that retreating looks better when it resembles a choice.
But her eyes found Agatha's for just one moment before she turned, and what was in them was not embarrassment. It was not even anger in the ordinary sense. It was the cold, quiet, absolute fury of a woman who had considered something settled and had just discovered it was not. Agatha filed that look carefully away. The Duke returned his attention to her with the same unhurried quality as before, as though the last 30 seconds had been a minor administrative matter now resolved. "Miss Bellamy," he said, and there was something different in his voice now, something that had not been there in the single word he had spoken before, something that required more careful listening to identify. "Perhaps this is not the room for the conversation we need to have." Around them, the assembly had resumed its noise, its movement, its performance of disinterest that fooled nobody. But the watchers were still watching. They always were. Agatha looked at the man in front of her. She looked at him the way she looked at problems she intended to solve. Directly, thoroughly, without the softening that came from wanting the answer to be something other than what it was. He was not what she had expected. She had expected arrogance in the blunt and careless form. What she found instead was something more controlled, and therefore considerably more difficult to read. "No," she agreed, "it is not." He gestured toward the corridor that led away from the main hall, toward the smaller reception room that sat off the east passage of Blackmere House. She knew the house reasonably well. The Blackmere family, Lord and Lady Fenwick, were old acquaintances of her father, and she had attended enough gatherings here to know the floor plan without consulting anyone. She walked beside the Duke, not behind him. Behind them, the hall erupted in the low, sustained roar of a room full of people who have been given something extraordinary to discuss. She heard her name twice before they reached the corridor. She did not turn around. Her father, Lord Gerald Bellamy, was standing near the hall's entrance with his old friend Colonel Baxter Midge, a broad and well-meaning man with white side whiskers and an honest face, and Lord Gerald's expression, as his daughter walked past him with the Duke of Ashford, was something she had never seen on him before. It was not quite a shock or hope. It was the face of a man watching something happen that he had set in motion without fully believing it would. She would deal with her father later. There was a great deal she intended to say to him, and none of it was suitable for a corridor. The reception room was smaller and quieter, and lit by candles rather than the great chandeliers of the entrance hall. A fire burned low in the grate. There were chairs arranged near it that no one had used yet that evening, and a side table with a decanter that had not been opened. It felt like a room that had been waiting. Duke Sebastian closed the door behind them. He left it open 2 inches, which was exactly correct for propriety, and told her he was aware of exactly how this looked and had chosen to manage it rather than ignore it. She stood near the fire and turned to face him. "My father," she said, "came to me this afternoon with a great deal of urgency and very little explanation. He told me to come here tonight. He told me to find you. He told me to tell you what he had told me." She paused. "He told me you needed a wife." The Duke stood with his hands behind his back and looked at her with those gray eyes that continued to give away less than she wanted them to. "And what did you make of that instruction?" "I thought it was either desperate or deliberate," Agatha said. "I have not yet decided which. Your father and I have spoken twice in the past year. The first conversation was his doing, the second was mine. He mentioned you in both." She had not known that. She kept her face entirely even. "What did he say?" "The first time," the Duke said, "he described you as the most capable person in his household. He meant it as a general observation. The second time, when I pressed him on the matter of what he believed would genuinely serve your future, he said the same thing with considerably more intention." Agatha was quiet for a moment. The fire shifted in the grate and sent a brief warmth across the side of her face. Outside the door, the distant sound of the assembly continued, music beginning now, the low note of strings being tuned.
"You pressed him," she said. "Why?"
The Duke did not answer immediately. He only looked at her. "Because I had already made a decision," he said finally, "and I wanted to know if the reality matched what I had decided, on the basis of incomplete information." "And does it?" Agatha asked. He looked at her for a long moment. "It exceeds it," he said quietly. The room was very still. Agatha held his gaze because looking away felt like conceding something she was not prepared to concede. Her pulse was entirely steady. She was quite proud of that. "You do not know me," she said. "No," he agreed. "That is rather the point." They spoke for 40 minutes in that small room, while the rest of Blackmere House danced and gossiped and sent occasional curious glances toward the east corridor. Duke Sebastian was direct, in a way that Agatha had not encountered in a man of his position. Most men of title spoke around things, approaching meaning through layers of implication and social convention that required careful translation. He did not do that. He asked questions that were specific and listened to the answers with complete attention. He asked about her interests. She told him truthfully. He asked about her opinions on three subjects that had nothing to do with marriage or society, and everything to do with character, and she gave him her actual opinions. He told her very little about himself in return. She noticed that, and chose not to remark on it yet. There would be time. What he did say was this. He was not looking for a convenient arrangement or a quiet domestic solution. He had been proposed to, maneuvered toward, and strategically introduced to 11 women in the past 4 years. Every one of those introductions had been engineered by someone with an interest in the outcome. He had declined all of them, not because the women were lacking, but because the architecture of those situations was dishonest, and he found dishonesty in foundational matters to be an insurmountable problem. "Then what is this?" Agatha asked. "My father sending me here with a message is not exactly without architecture." "No," the Duke said, "but you walking into me in that hall was not calculated, and the way you stood your ground afterward was entirely your own. I am interested in what is entirely your own." She studied him. "That is a considerable amount of weight to place on 90 seconds of corridor." "I have made significant decisions on less information," he said, without a trace of apology. "And I have had 4 years to understand what I am looking for, well enough to recognize it when it is standing in front of me, holding a crumpled letter." Agatha almost smiled. She stopped herself, but only just. "You noticed the letter." "I notice everything," he said simply. She believed him. When they returned to the main hall, the effect was immediate and visible. Conversation shifted, eyes moved. Lady Fenwick, their hostess, a kind and observant woman of 60, with silver hair and the social awareness of someone who had hosted gatherings for 40 years, appeared at Agatha's side within moments, with a warm hand on her arm and a look that communicated both congratulation and gentle warning simultaneously. "My dear," Lady Fenwick said softly, guiding her a few steps aside, "you have managed in one evening what 3 seasons of London society could not. I hope you know what you are stepping into."
"I am beginning to understand it,"
Agatha said. Lady Fenwick squeezed her arm once. "Lavinia Croft has been telling people for 6 months that the Duke would come to his senses before the year was out." She paused. She meant in her direction. "I gathered that," Agatha said. "She is not a woman who accepts redirection quietly," Lady Fenwick said. "I say this because I like you, not to alarm you." Agatha looked across the room. Lavinia Croft had repositioned herself near the far window with 2 women beside her, Miss Dorothea Plume and Mrs. Harriet Sedge, both of whom were known primarily for their loyalty to whoever currently held the most advantageous social position in the room. Lavinia was speaking. Her companions were listening with focused attention. Her eyes, as she spoke, moved once to Agatha, with a precision that had nothing accidental about it.
"Thank you," Agatha said to Lady Fenwick. "I appreciate the honesty."
She found her father near the supper room door. Colonel Midge had moved on, and Lord Gerald was alone, holding a glass he had not drunk from, and wearing the expression of a man who had sent a letter he could not recall. "She did well, your girl," said a voice beside Lord Gerald, and Agatha turned to find a man she had not met before, perhaps 60 years old, broad-shouldered, and weathered in the way of men who had spent time outdoors rather than in drawing rooms, with sharp brown eyes and a direct manner that suggested he had long since stopped caring what rooms thought of him.
"Hargrove," he said, extending a hand to Agatha directly, which was unusual.
"Sir Edmund Hargrove, I have known Sebastian since he was 14. I came tonight because he asked me to, which he has never done before." Agatha shook his hand.
"He asked you to come?"
"He asked me to observe," Hargrove said. "He does that sometimes. Wants an honest opinion from someone who will not give him a flattering one." He looked at her steadily. "You held your ground against Lavinia Croft in front of a full room. Most people do not manage that. She has a way of making retreat feel like a sensible option."
"I noticed," Agatha said.
"Sebastian noticed too," Hargrove said. "More than anything else that happened tonight, I suspect that is what mattered to him." He gave a brief nod, and moved away, with the ease of a man who said exactly what he meant, and saw no reason to elaborate. Agatha stood with her father, in the supper room doorway, and felt the evening settling around her. Her father touched her arm gently.
"Agatha," he said quietly,
"are you all right?"
She looked at him for a moment, at the worry in his face, and the hope underneath it, and the guilt below that, layered in the way that feelings layered in people who loved imperfectly, and knew it.
"I am thinking," she said.
"About what?"
She looked back across the room. Duke Sebastian had returned to the main hall and was speaking with Lord Fenwick near the window. He was not looking in her direction, but Sir Edmund Hargrove, standing a little apart with his drink, was watching her with those sharp brown eyes and a small expression that might, on another face, have been called a smile.
"About the fact," Agatha said slowly, "that I walked into this evening expecting nothing, and appear to be leaving it with rather a great deal to consider."
Her father was quiet for a moment. Then he said, very softly, "Your mother would have handled it exactly as you did." Agatha did not respond to that. She could not, quite. She pressed her hand briefly over her father's, where it rested on her arm, and then straightened and looked back at the room with clear eyes. Across the hall, Lavinia Croft was still watching, calculating, and wearing that composed and perfect expression. Agatha met her gaze evenly, and did not look away first. The evening was far from over, and something told her, with a certainty she could not yet explain, that what had begun in this crowded hall with a collision, and a whispered sentence and one quiet, world-altering word, was only the very first page of something considerably longer. She intended to read every word of it.
3 days after the gathering at Blackmere House, a note arrived at Bellamy Park with no signature. It was not delivered by post. It was not handed to the door by a messenger in livery. It was found tucked beneath the front door in the early hours of the morning by the housemaid, young Polly's cousin Agnes, who brought it upstairs to Agatha with wide eyes and a face that had gone the color of cold porridge. Agatha opened it at her writing desk while the house was still quiet. The handwriting was elegant, controlled, the kind of hand that had been trained rather than natural, every letter placed with deliberate precision, which somehow made it worse rather than better. It read, "You do not know what you have walked into. Leave it alone while you still can do so gracefully. Some doors, once opened, cannot be closed without considerable damage to those foolish enough to have touched the handle. Consider yourself warned with kindness. The next reminder will not be so gentle." Agatha read it twice. Then she folded it carefully, placed it in the small locked box she kept in the bottom drawer of her desk, and went downstairs to breakfast with a perfectly steady face. Beatrice was already at the table, bright-eyed and full of questions she had been storing for 3 days like a drawer stuffed too full to close properly. Their father had not yet come down. "You have had a letter," Beatrice said immediately. She had always been impossible to deceive about small things.
"I have had several," Agatha said, reaching for the teapot.
"Not that kind," Beatrice said.
"Your face is doing the thing it does when you are deciding not to feel something yet."
Agatha poured her tea and considered her sister for a moment. Beatrice was sharp, loyal, and she was 19 years old with an enormous heart. Agatha decided, for now,
to say nothing about it.
I am going to Grenfell today, Agatha said instead. Beatrice sat up straighter.
Again? The Duke sent word yesterday evening. There are matters he wishes to discuss, and he has invited Father and myself, both.
She set down the teapot. Father has declined.
He declined.
He says he is unwell. Agatha looked at her cup.
He is not unwell. He is afraid of what a direct conversation with the Duke might require him to say aloud, that he has so far only said to me.
I will go without him.
Then I am coming with you, Beatrice said immediately.
You are not.
Agatha.
Beatrice.
Agatha looked at her sister.
Stay here. Keep the house. If anyone calls, tell them I am visiting the Fenwicks.
Beatrice did not look satisfied, but she recognized the tone and subsided. The Ashford carriage arrived at 11.
Mrs. Dunmore was already waiting at the front door with her hat on and her gloves buttoned, because Mrs. Dunmore was always ready before anyone else, and considered lateness a mild form of moral failure. The road to Grenfell was familiar now. Agatha watched it pass, with less cataloguing than the first time, and more thinking. She turned the note over in her mind, not the words exactly, but the intention behind them. It had been written by someone who was accustomed to being effective, someone who believed that a single well-placed threat, delivered with the veneer of courtesy, would be enough to make a sensible woman step back from an inconvenient situation.
They had miscalculated. Grenfell House received her with the same quiet efficiency as before. Stanton at the door, Mr. Foss appearing precisely when required. But something was different today. There were two horses in the front courtyard that had not been there on her previous visit, both rode dusty and still breathing from a recent journey. And when Stanton led her not to the library, but to the larger drawing room on the ground floor, she understood why. There were three people already in the room when she entered. Duke Sebastian stood near the window, and beside him, seated in the high-backed chair nearest the fire, was a woman Agatha had not met. She was perhaps 55, with silver-streaked dark hair and a spine so straight it looked architectural. She wore an expression of complete composure that reminded Agatha, startlingly, of the Duke himself. The resemblance was not physical, so much as atmospheric. This woman and the Duke occupied space in the same way, as though they had both decided long ago exactly how much of themselves they intended to reveal, and had not revised that decision since. The third person was Sir Edmund Hargrove, who rose when Agatha entered and gave her a nod of genuine welcome.
Miss Bellamy, the Duke said. Thank you for coming. Allow me to introduce my aunt, Lady Dorinda Ashford.
Lady Dorinda looked at Agatha with the direct, measuring attention of someone who had made important assessments of people for decades and had grown efficient at it.
Sit down, Miss Bellamy, she said, not unkindly, but with the authority of a woman who did not phrase invitations as suggestions.
Agatha sat.
I have heard a great deal about you, Lady Dorinda said. Some of it from my nephew, which is remarkable because he speaks about very few people.
Some of it from Edmund, which is more reliable because Edmund has no interest in flattering anyone. And some of it this morning from a source I found considerably less credible.
Agatha kept her expression even. May I ask which source?
Lavinia Croft, Lady Dorinda said, as though the name tasted of something she had not ordered.
She called on me at my town residence yesterday afternoon, uninvited. She spent 40 minutes explaining, with great elegance and absolutely no subtlety, why a connection between my nephew and your family would be socially inadvisable, personally inappropriate, and ultimately damaging to the Ashford name.
She paused. She brought a list.
The room was very still for a moment.
A written list, Sir Edmund said from his chair, with the dry precision of a man reporting a military absurdity.
Indexed, Lady Dorinda added.
Duke Sebastian had not moved from his position near the window. He was watching Agatha with that steady, grey attention of his, and she had the distinct impression he was less interested in telling her what had happened than in watching what she did with the information.
What was on the list? Agatha asked.
Social objections primarily, Lady Dorinda said. Your family's reduced circumstances, your lack of a London season, your father's general withdrawal from society over recent years, the usual architecture of dismissal, dressed in the language of concern.
She folded her hands in her lap.
She also implied, without quite stating it directly, that you had engineered the encounter at Blackmere House.
I walked into him carrying a letter, Agatha said. That is not engineering. That is poor navigation.
Sir Edmund made a sound that was not quite a laugh, but was in that direction. Lady Dorinda's expression shifted by a small but meaningful degree.
She also said, she continued, in a tone that had become slightly more deliberate, that should this connection proceed, she would ensure that certain stories reached the ears of people positioned to make things difficult for your family. She was not specific about the stories. Vagueness in that kind of threat is intentional. It suggests the threat has flexibility.
Agatha absorbed this without moving. She said this to you directly. She implied it with the clarity of a woman who believes in leaving herself a route of retreat, Lady Dorinda said.
But yes, the meaning was unmistakable. Agatha thought of the note in the locked box at her writing desk. She had not yet told anyone about it. She looked at the Duke now and made a decision.
A note was left under the door of Bellamy Park 3 days ago, she said. No signature.
It warned me to withdraw while I could still do so gracefully, and stated that the next reminder would not be gentle.
She kept her voice level. I had suspected the source. I am now considerably more certain of it.
The quality of stillness in the room changed completely. Duke Sebastian moved from the window for the first time since she had entered the room. He crossed to the chair across from her and sat down and looked at her curiously.
You did not send a word, he said.
I had not decided what it meant yet, Agatha said.
I needed more information before I drew conclusions.
And now? He asked.
Now I have enough, she said.
Lady Dorinda was watching this exchange with the attention of a woman reading a very interesting document.
Sir Edmund had set down his cup.
She will not stop at notes, Duke Sebastian said.
It was not a question.
No, Agatha agreed. She will not.
Truthfully, she did not stop at notes. 4 days later, Agatha was returning from a morning visit to the Fenwick household with Mrs. Dunmore, when their small hired carriage was forced to a stop on the narrow lane that ran between the old mill and the bottom of the Grenfeld Road. A cart had overturned across the full width of the lane, spilling timber across the path, and two men were making slow and inefficient work of clearing it.
Mrs. Dunmore looked at the obstruction with narrow eyes.
This lane is not frequently used, she said quietly to Agatha.
We took it this morning because the main road was flooded near the bridge.
Yes, Agatha said. She was already looking at the trees on either side of the lane, and the high hedgerows that made it impossible to see more than 10 feet in any direction.
And the only person who knew we took it this morning was the Fenwick household.
Mrs. Dunmore went very still.
The Fenwick household, she said carefully, which Miss Lavinia Croft is currently visiting as a guest.
Agatha had not known that.
She filed it immediately and looked at their driver, old Thomas, who had been with the Bellamy household for 20 years and had the unhurried good sense of someone who had seen enough unexpected things that very few of them alarmed him anymore.
Thomas, she said, can you turn the carriage?
Not in this lane, Miss Agatha, he said.
Too narrow. We'd have to go forward and find the wider point past the mill.
Then go forward, she said, carefully, and now.
The carriage moved.
As it passed the overturned cart, one of the men clearing timber straightened and looked directly at Agatha through the carriage window with an expression that was flat and assessing and lasted precisely 2 seconds before he looked away. Her heart was entirely steady.
So, she kept her hands still in her lap and her eyes forward and thought with complete clarity about what the next necessary steps were.
When they reached Bellamy Park, she went directly to her desk and wrote 2 letters. The first, to Sir Edmund Hargrove, brief and factual, describing what had happened in the lane without interpretation or alarm.
The second, to Duke Sebastian, equally factual, with one additional sentence at the end that said simply, I believe the situation has moved beyond social inconvenience, and I think you should know that I am not frightened, but I am paying close attention.
She sealed both letters and sent them with the fastest horse in the stable.
The reply from Duke Sebastian arrived before evening.
It was short. It said, Do not use the Grenfeld Road alone.
I am sending two of my men to Bellamy Park tomorrow morning. They will be available to you whenever you travel until this matter is resolved. This is not a suggestion. Agatha read it twice. Then she sat quietly for a moment with the letter in her hands and felt something she had not expected to feel. Not reassurance exactly, but something close to it. She wrote back, "Thank you. I accept. Though I should tell you, I am not accustomed to being managed." His reply came the following morning. I had gathered that. "I am not attempting to manage you. I am attempting to ensure you remain in a position to manage yourself." She read that three times. Beatrice, who had been watching the exchange of letters with barely contained curiosity, finally said, "What does he write?" "Sensibly," Agatha said, which was not an answer, but was all she intended to give. The two men the Duke sent were named Coates and Mr. Aldwyn Peel. Coates was enormous and quiet, with the bearing of someone who had formerly been employed in a context that required physical readiness. Peel was younger, lean and watchful, and had eyes that moved constantly in the way of someone trained to observe the perimeter. Neither of them intruded. They simply existed at a careful and appropriate distance from wherever Agatha was, which she found both sensible and faintly extraordinary. On the third morning after their arrival, Agatha was walking in the rear garden of Bellamy Park with Beatrice when she heard the front gate open. She came around the side of the house in time to see Lavinia Croft stepping down from her own carriage with the composed ease of a woman making a social call, dressed with that precise and deliberate elegance she wore like armor, and accompanied by her companion, a quiet and watchful older woman named Mrs. Gould, who said very little and noticed everything. Coates had appeared at the corner of the house. He did not move toward the visitor. He simply stood there, visible and large, and Lavinia's eyes went to him for a single fraction of a second before returning front with practiced indifference. Agatha walked to meet her guest at the front step. "Miss Croft," she said, "this is unexpected." "I hope I am not intruding," Lavinia said, with a smile that had been constructed with considerable skill to appear entirely genuine. "I am staying with the Fenwicks, as you may know, and Lady Fenwick mentioned she had seen you recently. I thought it was the neighborly thing to call." "Of course," Agatha said. "Please come in." She showed Lavinia to the front sitting room and sent Agnes for tea and sat across from her with Mrs. Dunmore present in the corner chair, with her sewing and her sharp eyes and the expression of someone fully alert behind a mask of domestic tranquility. Lavinia looked around the sitting room with the particular attention of someone performing admiration while actually conducting an inventory. "Bellamy Park is charming," she said. "I had not visited in some years. Your mother used to keep the most extraordinary garden." "She did," Agatha said. "We have maintained it as best we can." "How difficult it must be," Lavinia said, with a warmth so precisely calibrated, it would have been invisible to anyone not looking for the calculation beneath it, managing a household of this size, particularly without a mother's guidance. "You carry it so well." "Thank you," Agatha said. "I imagine," Lavinia continued, settling her cup on her knee with perfect elegance, "that recent events have added considerably to the weight of it. Social attention can be so exhausting, particularly when it arrives so suddenly and without warning." Agatha looked at her directly. "I manage well with surprises," she said. "I have had considerable practice." Something in Lavinia's eyes sharpened and was immediately smoothed over. "Of course, though I wonder sometimes," she said, her voice dropping slightly in register to a tone of apparent intimacy, "whether the kindest thing a sensible woman can do for herself is to recognize when a situation is not what it appears and withdraw before it becomes complicated." "I find," Agatha said calmly, "that withdrawing from things I do not yet fully understand is not generally my preference. I find it more useful to stay until I understand them completely." The room was quiet for a moment. Lavinia smiled. It was a different smile from the first one. This one did not bother quite as much with warmth. "Sebastian Ashford," Lavinia said, dropping the title with the deliberate ease of someone demonstrating familiarity, "is not a simple man, Miss Bellamy. He has a history that is not commonly known and a temperament that has consequences for those close to him. I speak from knowledge rather than speculation. I would not wish you to find yourself in a position you had not anticipated.
That is very considerate, Agatha said. May I ask how long you have known the Duke?
7 years, Lavinia said.
And in 7 years, Agatha said, what have you understood about him that you believe I have not?
The directness of it landed in the room like a key turning in a lock. Lavinia's composure held, but the effort was more visible now.
That he does not make decisions lightly, Lavinia said.
And when they go wrong, the consequences are significant.
Then I shall ensure, Agatha said, that nothing goes wrong.
They finished their tea with perfect civility. Lavinia departed after 40 minutes, with grace intact, and eyes that told an entirely different story from her mouth. At the gate, she paused and turned back to look at Agatha, standing on the front step.
I do hope we will be friends, Lavinia said pleasantly. The county is a small world. It is always better to be friendly within it.
Absolutely, Agatha said. She watched the carriage until it was gone. Then she turned to find Mrs. Dunmore at her shoulder.
She came to measure you, Mrs. Dunmore said.
Yes, Agatha said.
And to warn you again, in a way she could deny, was a warning.
Yes. What will you do?
Agatha looked at the empty lane where the carriage had been. She thought about the note in the locked box.
The overturned cart in the narrow lane, the flat, assessing eyes of the man who had looked through the carriage window, the indexed list Lavinia had brought to Lady Dorinda, the 40 minutes of elegant threat, dressed as neighborly concern.
Tomorrow, she said, I am going to Grenfell,
and this time, I am going to ask the Duke directly what history Lavinia Croft believes she has with him, because whatever she is protecting, it is not simply pride.
She turned back toward the house. It is something she is genuinely afraid of losing.
Mrs. Dunmore followed her inside.
And if it is something significant, Agatha paused in the doorway and looked back once more at the quiet lane, the frost-tipped hedgerows, the pale winter sky above Bellamy Park.
Then I will deal with it the way I deal with everything, she said, by understanding it completely before I decide what to do with it.
She went inside and closed the door behind her.
The morning Agatha rode to Grenfell, the sky was the color of old pewter, and the wind had teeth. She arrived with Coates and Peel flanking the carriage, and her mind already arranged in the particular order she gave it, when she intended to ask questions that required honest answers.
Mr. Foss met her at the door with his notepad and his efficient expression, and told her the Duke was in the east courtyard, and had been since early morning.
That was unexpected. She followed Foss through the house, and out through a narrow passage that opened into a walled courtyard she had not seen on either of her previous visits.
It was a working space, rather than a decorative one, stone-flagged and open to the sky, with a long wooden structure along one wall that housed equipment she recognized from country estates as belonging to horses and their management.
Duke Sebastian was standing in the center of the courtyard with his coat off despite the cold, working a young gray horse on a long rein with the focused patience of someone who had been doing this for a very long time. The horse was nervous, circling wide and tossing its head, and the Duke moved with it rather than against it, adjusting without forcing, his attention entirely on the animal and the quality of communication between them. He had not heard her arrive.
Agatha stood at the courtyard entrance and watched for a moment without announcing herself.
This was the first time she had seen him in a context that was entirely unperformed. Not the library with its documents, not the drawing room with its careful introductions, not the crowded hall at Blackmere with its audience and its architecture of social pressure.
This was simply a man and a frightened horse in a cold courtyard at 7 in the morning. And the patience she observed in him here was real in a way that nothing managed for an audience could be.
He noticed her after another minute. He brought the horse to a gentle stop, handed the reins to a waiting groom, and reached for his coat from the fence post without hurry.
You came early, he said.
I have a number of things to ask you, she said. I thought it better to ask them before the day is filled with other things.
He pulled on his coat and looked at her with that steady gray attention.
Come inside. They sat in the library again, which was becoming their room by habit, if not by agreement. The fire had been lit, and tea arrived without anyone asking for it. Outside the tall windows, the pewter sky had begun to release a thin, cold rain that ran in streams down the glass. Agatha set her gloves on the table beside her and looked at him directly. "Tell me about Lavinia Croft," she said. He did not look away. He did not rearrange his expression or reach for a more comfortable posture. He looked at her with that same level of attention and said, "What has she done?" "She has done several things," Agatha said. "The note, the lane, the visit to your aunt with an indexed list of objections, the call to Bellamy Park." She paused. "I want to know what she is protecting, because it is not simply pride, and it is not simply preference. A woman does not build that kind of architecture of interference around a social disappointment. She builds it around something that feels like survival." The fire moved in the grate. The rain against the glass was steady and quiet. 7 years ago, the Duke said, my father had been dead for 3 years, and I was 27, and considerably less careful than I am now. Lavinia Croft was introduced to me at a London gathering by her uncle, Lord Aldous Croft, who had business connections with the Ashford estate. She was 22. She was beautiful, and she was intelligent, and I spent 4 months in her company, believing both of those things were sufficient. Agatha listened without moving. I did not offer for her, he said. I want to be precise about that. There was no formal offer, and no accepted proposal, and no broken engagement. What there was a period of attention that her family interpreted as intention, and when I withdrew that attention because I understood that what I had taken for depth was performance, Lord Aldous Croft told a number of people in London that I had behaved dishonorably.
Had you?
Agatha asked. He considered the question with the seriousness it deserved, rather than the defensiveness it invited.
I had been careless, he said finally. I had allowed a situation to develop further than was fair to her before I understood it clearly enough to act on.
That was a failure of attention on my part, and I do not excuse it. He paused, but I had not promised her anything, and what her uncle told people was not accurate. What did he tell people? That I had made a private offer and then publicly withdrawn it to humiliate her family, the Duke said. It was not true, but it was believed in certain circles, and it followed me into the next season and the one after that. I withdrew from London society for 2 years as a result. Not from guilt, from the particular exhaustion of attempting to correct a story that had already decided its own shape. Agatha absorbed this carefully. And Lavinia, she said. Did she tell the same story her uncle told? She told a version of it that was more careful than his, he said. Her version implied rather than stated, which is more difficult to disprove, and more lasting in its effect. And she has been waiting, Agatha said slowly, for 7 years, for you to come back around to her. Because if you were to choose her now, it would rewrite the story entirely. It would mean the withdrawal had been about timing, rather than rejection. The Duke looked at her steadily. Yes, and I have appeared, Agatha said, and disrupted that waiting. Yes. She sat with that for a moment. Then she said, is there anything else I should know? Anything that would change what I understand if I learned it later rather than now? He was quiet for a long moment. The rain ran down the glass. Somewhere in the house, a door opened and closed. Then he said, my father's death was not straightforward. The room changed quality entirely.
What do you mean?
Agatha said. He died of a sudden illness, the Duke said. That is the official account, and it is not untrue. But there were circumstances around the weeks before his death that were never fully examined. Papers that were missing from his study afterward. A conversation he had with Lord Aldous Croft 10 days before he died that no one who knew about it would speak of openly. He paused. I have spent 7 years trying to understand what happened, and I am close. Not there yet, but close. Agatha's mind was moving very quickly and very quietly. Lord Aldous Croft, she said. Lavinia's uncle. Yes. Who spread the story about you after you withdrew from Lavinia? Yes.
Who?
who would have considerable interest in keeping you socially isolated and your attention directed away from old history.
Yes, the Duke said. Sebastian, she said, and it was the first time she had used his given name, and neither of them remarked on it, and both of them noticed it.
How close is close? He reached into the inside pocket of his coat and placed a single folded document on the table between them.
This came to me 4 days ago, he said. From my father's former solicitor, an elderly man named Mr. Barnard Quill, who has been in declining health in Bath for the past 3 years. He wrote to me because he believes he does not have much time remaining, and there is something he has been carrying for 11 years that he can no longer carry alone.
Agatha looked at the document. She looked at him.
May I? He nodded.
She unfolded it and read. It was a letter in a shaking elderly hand, covering 2 pages. She read every word of it twice. When she set it down, her hands were completely still, and her face was completely composed, and inside her chest, something had gone very quiet.
He witnessed it, she said.
Yes. Lord Aldous Croft came to your father 10 days before his death, with a document he pressured him to sign. A transfer of a significant portion of the Ashford commercial interests, structured to appear voluntary. And your father signed it, because Croft had something over him that Quill does not specify, but describes as significant enough that your father had no choice.
Yes, the Duke said.
And then your father died, Agatha said. And Croft had what he wanted, and a dead man to blame it on, and a grieving 22-year-old new Duke, who knew nothing about any of it.
Yes.
And 7 years later, Agatha said, when you began quietly looking into the old accounts, Lavinia started appearing in your orbit again, not because she was still hoping you would choose her, because her uncle sent her. The silence that followed was the longest one yet. Duke Sebastian looked at her across the table, covered in documents and firelight, and the particular gravity of a truth that had been underground for 11 years and had just broken the surface.
I did not know that last part for certain, he said quietly, until you said it just now.
Everything moved quickly after that. Agatha did not go home that evening. She sent word to Bellamy Park with Peel, a careful message for Beatrice that said only that she was safe and would return tomorrow, and that Beatrice should say nothing to their father until she arrived. She stayed at Grenfell under Lady Dorinda's roof, which resolved all questions of propriety, and spent the evening in the library with the Duke and Sir Edmund Hargrove, who had arrived at 4 in the afternoon, as though he had been expecting to be needed. They worked through everything methodically. The letter from Mr. Barnard Quill, the Ashford estate accounts from the year of the late Duke's death, a second document that Sir Edmund produced from his own coat pocket, with the manner of a man who had been waiting for the right moment, a letter he had received from a land agent in Yorkshire 6 months ago that had seemed at the time like an isolated irregularity, and now fit into the larger picture with the precision of a piece that had always belonged there. Lord Aldous Croft had moved the transferred Ashford interests through 3 separate business structures over 11 years, each one at a careful distance from the next, each one designed to make the original source difficult to trace. He had been thorough. He had been patient. He had been, for 11 years, entirely successful. He had not accounted for an elderly solicitor in Bath, with a conscience that had outlasted his fear. Sir Edmund knew a man in London, a solicitor of considerable skill and discretion, named Mr. Walter Abbs, who had handled sensitive matters for 2 other noble families in recent years, with both effectiveness and absolute confidentiality. A letter was written to Mr. Abbs that same evening. Sir Edmund signed it. The Duke added a postscript. It was sealed and dispatched before midnight with one of Grenfell's most reliable riders. Agatha wrote the summary of what they knew in her own hand, because her handwriting was the clearest of the 3, and organization under pressure was something she did without thinking. She arranged the evidence in chronological sequence, noted the gaps, identified the points that still required corroboration, and wrote 3 questions at the bottom of the final page that she believed were the ones Mr. Abbs would need answered first. The Duke read what she had written and was quiet for a long moment. You should have been a solicitor, Sir Edmund said to her, not unkindly. Women are not permitted to be solicitors, Agatha said.
Precisely my point, Sir Edmund said. They worked until past midnight.
Lady Dorinda appeared at 10, with a tray she had carried herself, set it down without comment, looked at the documents spread across the library table with sharp assessing eyes, and said only, Croft always was a careful man. Careful men make the worst enemies because they plan for the obvious responses. Plan for something he would not expect. Then she left them to it. It was the Duke who said, just before midnight, There is one more thing. He said it to Agatha specifically, not to the room. Sir Edmund appeared to find something requiring his attention in a document at the far end of the table.
Lavinia does not know the full extent of what her uncle has done, the Duke said. I am as certain of that as I can be without speaking to her directly. She has been used as an instrument by a man she trusts and believes is protecting her interests. She is dangerous because she is genuinely motivated, but she is not fully aware of what she is serving. Agatha considered this carefully. That does not make what she has done acceptable.
No, he said, it does not. The note and the lane were real, and I intend to deal with both of them directly, but it changes what she is. She is not a villain who has chosen this fully.
She is a woman who has been pointed at a target by someone who understood how to use her pride and her hope and her loyalty against her. He paused.
I thought you should know that, because when this is over, the way it is handled will matter.
Agatha looked at him steadily. You have thought about her welfare.
I have thought about what is true, he said, which includes the fact that she has been wronged too, in a different way from my father, but wronged nonetheless. She sat with that for a moment. The fire had burned low, and the rain had stopped some time ago, and the library was very quiet, except for the occasional sound of Sir Edmund's paper at the far end of the table.
All right, she said. Then when it is over, we handle it with that in mind.
He looked at her across the table.
We, he said.
Yes, she said simply. We.
It was, she thought afterward, perhaps the most significant conversation they had ever had, and it had consisted of two words.
The following weeks were not quiet. Mr. Walter Abbs arrived from London within 4 days and proved to be exactly what Sir Edmund had promised, precise, discreet, and possessed of a legal mind that moved through complexity the way a good hunting dog moves through undergrowth, efficiently and without wasted motion.
He spoke with Mr. Barnard Quill in Bath by correspondence, and then in person when it became clear that Quill's testimony needed to be formally recorded before his health declined further. Lord Aldous Croft became aware that something was moving against him approximately 10 days after Mr. Abbs's arrival. Agatha knew this because Lavinia Croft appeared at Bellamy Park again, but this time without her composed elegance intact. She arrived in a hired carriage, rather than her own, without Mrs. Gould, and the knock at the door had an urgency to it that Agnes reported with wide eyes before Agatha had even reached the landing. She received Lavinia in the front sitting room. Mrs. Dunmore was present. Coates was visible through the window. Lavinia sat down without being invited and looked at Agatha with fear.
What has Sebastian done? Lavinia said.
He has pursued a truth that has been buried for 11 years, Agatha said steadily.
You should ask your uncle what that truth is. I believe he owes you the explanation more than I do.
Lavinia stared at her. My uncle has nothing to do with Sebastian.
I think, Agatha said gently, that you will find he has a great deal to do with him.
And I think when you understand what has been done in the years you have spent in your uncle's orbit, you will find that your anger, which is considerable and has been directed at the wrong person, belongs somewhere else entirely. The silence that followed was long and complicated. Lavinia's face moved through several expressions in rapid succession, each one more unguarded than the last.
He told me, she said finally, very quietly,
that Sebastian had deliberately ruined our family's standing, that the withdrawal was calculated to damage us,
that we had every right to reclaim what had been taken.
Your family's standing was not damaged by the Duke, Agatha said.
Your uncle told you a story that kept your attention and your loyalty pointed in a direction that was useful to him.
I am sorry,
I understand. That is not a small thing to hear. Lavinia looked at her hands. For the first time since Agatha had encountered her, she looked tired, young, and genuinely shaken. The note, Lavinia said. The lane. Those things. She stopped. Were they your uncle's instruction, or your own? Agatha asked. He paused.
He said it was necessary, Lavinia said. He said you were a threat to the family, and I needed to make you understand what you were stepping into.
She looked up. I did not know what he was protecting. I thought I was protecting myself.
I know, Agatha said. Lord Aldous Croft was confronted by Mr. Abbs.
Then the full weight of the documented evidence 3 weeks later, in the presence of two witnesses and a representative of the relevant legal authority, in a meeting that lasted 4 hours and ended with an agreement that the transferred interests would be returned to the Ashford estate in full.
Another thing is that Croft would withdraw entirely from all business and social engagement connected to the Ashford name, permanently, under terms that Mr. Abbs had structured. There were no public proceedings. The Duke had not wanted them. Not for Croft's sake, which he made clear, but for Lavinia's, which he also made clear, and for the memory of his father, who had been pressured and cornered and had spent the last 10 days of his life carrying a weight no one had helped him carry, and deserved to have that understood privately, rather than performed publicly. Agatha was at Grenfell the evening it was finished. She was in the library, which was simply their room now without either of them having formally decided it, working through correspondence at one end of the long table while the Duke read at the other, when Mr. Foss brought in the final confirmation from Mr. Abbs. The Duke read it. He set it down. He was quiet for a moment, that had a particular quality of weight to it, the weight of something long carried finally set on the ground. It is done, he said. Yes, Agatha said. He looked at her across the table. The fire was good and warm, and the evening outside was clear for the first time in weeks, the winter stars sharp and cold above the walled garden. I owe you a considerable debt, he said. You owe me nothing, she said. I was there because I chose to be. Why? He asked, not rhetorically. He genuinely wanted to know. She considered the question with the honesty it deserved. Because the first night in that hall, when you looked at me and said what you said, I understood that whatever this was, it was not simple, and it was not convenient, and it was not the kind of thing a sensible person walks into without full awareness of what they are choosing. She paused, and I decided I would rather choose it with full awareness than retreat from it without understanding what I was leaving behind. He was quiet for a long moment. Outside, somewhere in the walled garden, the wind moved through the old trees with a sound like a long breath finally released. Miss Bellamy, he said. Agatha, she said. Agatha, he said. I had decided before Blackmere House that if I ever found a person I could sit in a room with, in complete honesty, and feel the quality of the silence improve rather than deteriorate, I would not let the opportunity pass me by out of caution. She looked at him steadily. And have you found that? I have been sitting in this room with you for 4 hours, he said, and have not once wished I were somewhere else. For me, that is unprecedented. She almost smiled. She let it happen this time. That is either a very romantic thing to say, or a very low standard. Perhaps both, he said. There was a warmth in his expression now that had been building so gradually across the weeks of their acquaintance. My father sent me to you with a message, she said. He did, the Duke agreed. And you said, perhaps, she said. I did, he said. I have been waiting, she said, to find out if perhaps it was a beginning or an evasion. Duke Sebastian Ashford looked at her across the firelit library, across the table covered in the paperwork of a truth finally told, and said, it was always a beginning. The fire spoke quietly in the grate. The stars held their positions above the garden, and in the library of Grenfell House, on a clear winter evening, the silence between two people who had chosen each other with full awareness and no retreat was the best kind of silence there is, the kind that does not need filling.